Welcome back to the program. As we turn our attention now to the minds of small babies, we used to think that babies were blank slates, that there was very little going on. Modern research shows us a very different reality that we're going to talk about today with my guest, Allison Gopnik. She's the author of the new book, The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. She's a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. She's the author of the previous book, The Scientist in the Crib. It is my pleasure to have Allison Gopnik with us today to talk about The Philosophical Baby. Allison, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Pleasure to have you here. You know, the George Bernard Shaw quote that says, you know, some men see things as they are and ask why, and others dream things that have never been and ask why not. In many ways, it could apply to the minds of babies, as we're discovering.
Well, one of the things that I think is most interesting that we've discovered is that young children's imagination, which we used to think was a sign that they were confused about the difference between reality and fantasy, actually turns out to be a way that children and human beings in general have of doing that why not kind of reasoning.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, babies, we're discovering, can reason, can deal in this realm of probability.
Well, even very young babies, it turns out, rather staggeringly, already are considering different alternatives, at least unconsciously, and saying, oh yeah, this one's more likely than that one. A wonderful recent experiment by someone who we just hired at Berkeley, Fei Xu, showed this very, very cleverly. What she did was she showed babies a box full of mixed up ping pong balls, mostly red with a few white ones. And then she showed them either someone taking out four red balls and one white ball, which is the sort of expected probable outcome, or else she showed them someone taking out four white balls and one red one. Now, that's possible, but it's not nearly as probable given that there were mostly red balls in the box. And the amazing thing was that eight-month-old babies looked much longer when they saw the unexpected, improbable outcome than the probable one.
Mm-hmm.
So that meant that they detected that one thing was more likely than another, even as very, very small babies.
And what does this tell us about the way these babies learn?
Well, we're just starting to understand something about the underlying mechanisms that are there in their brains that let them learn as much as they do. And babies seem to be using some of the same learning techniques that computer scientists use in very complicated, sophisticated computers that are designed to go and learn about the world.
Mm-hmm.
So a good way of summarizing this is that babies are a lot like scientists. They observe, they look at the statistics of the world. It's as if they're doing little data analyses. And they also do experiments on the world. We grown-ups call those experiments getting into everything.
Right.
But other recent studies show that when babies and young children are getting into everything, what they're really doing is exploring and figuring out how the world works.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you talk about is essentially what they're doing is kind of multitasking, that they don't necessarily focus and plan the way adults do, but what they do is a kind of multitasking.
Well, I think it's even in some ways beyond multitasking. What they do is take in information about anything in the world that's unexpected or new or relevant. So we adults almost always think about our thinking in terms of our ability to make a goal-directed plan, to say, okay, here's what I want to do, and here's how I accomplish it. So even when we talk about multitasking, we say, oh, okay, here's goal one and goal two and goal three, and I have to, you know, check my email and drink my tea and eat my breakfast all at the same time. Babies are very different. Babies don't seem to be goal-directed and planned the way we are as adults. Babies are out there just trying to get as much knowledge and information from the world as they possibly can. So they're multi-seeing. They're looking out in the world and picking out everything that's going to tell them the most about what the world is like.
Right. And part of how they evolve, part of how their thinking and reasoning evolves, seems to be the way they make these connections between these different things that they're looking at.
Exactly. So what seems to happen is we know that even very young babies, even newborn babies, already know a lot about the world. So it isn't as if babies are ever the blank slate or the blooming, buzzing confusion that philosophers used to think. But what happens is that babies start out organizing the world, but very quickly they start to notice connections between things that happen in the world that they don't know about to begin with. So they'll start noticing things like the fact that causes are followed by effects. That, for instance, when they kick in the crib, that the crib shakes and the toys and mobiles shake. That's not something that they're born knowing, but it's something that they very, very quickly start to learn. And by the time they're 2 or 3 years old, we've done experiments that show that they can use that information about what's connected to what to figure out something about how the world works.
Mm-hmm. And talk about the ways in which that affects, those experiences really affect how they're programmed into adulthood.
Well, one of the ideas that we have now is that we can think about children and childhood as being an essential part of how it is that we manage to do all the things that we can do as adults. One of the mysteries, one of the evolutionary mysteries about human beings is that we have this very, very long period of childhood, this long protected immaturity when we have to invest so much in just keeping our babies alive. And that's kind of a puzzle. Why would we be designed that way? And the answer seems to be that as adults, we can learn to do an incredibly wide variety of things, and we can survive in an incredibly wide variety of environments. The way we manage to do that is because in childhood, we have this protected period when we can just learn about the world around us, find out, oh, what are the rules? How does this world that I've been born into actually work? And once we have that information, once we know how the world works, then we can take that information and put it to use to do all the important goal-directed planning that we do as grown-ups.
How do you think this information will be used or misused by parents that always want a smarter baby?
Yes. Well, I think one of the things that's happened is in our particular historical moment, we're at a rather strange moment in terms of the way that we take care of children, because on the one hand, we don't have the kind of big families to help take care of children and teach us how to take care of children that we once did. It's very strange to think that there are people nowadays who have children who've never even held a baby before. That's unprecedented in history. On the other hand, we properly think that learning and knowledge are very important. So parents and even governments sometimes treat this research as if it says, oh, we should put babies in school much earlier, or we should teach them letters by giving them flashcards, or we should put them in academic enrichment programs or buy them fancy electronic educational toys. But in fact, the moral is exactly the opposite. That kind of learning is the kind of learning that we do as grown-ups when we set ourselves a task and set out to intentionally achieve it, when we make a curriculum and goals and tests. That's very different from the kind of learning that babies are doing. And I think it's a terribly sad irony that we spend millions, even billions of dollars on these toys, electronic toys and programs that aren't really going to make any difference to babies. And we spend hardly any money on the caregivers, the people, and we know that they're the ones who really do make a difference to babies.
Mm-hmm. And in doing all of this, are we closing off too soon the kind of speculation, the kind of learning that babies are doing? Do we cut that off too soon by putting them in the world of planning, essentially?
Well, I think that's right. Now, I think one thing is that babies will try to do that no matter what. But I think we may be losing something, both for the babies and for us as adults, if we value the kind of directed, focused planning over the kind of wide-eyed speculation. So one of the things that I say is that you could think about children as being the research and development department of the human species.
Mm-hmm.
And we're production and marketing. They're designed to explore the world, and we're designed to exploit all the learning that we do as children. And a good company, especially one like Homo sapiens, who specializes in innovation, needs to have both the blue sky speculation and research and development and the capacity for focus and planning. And we will make a mistake if we just emphasize one at the expense of the other.
What can we learn from all of this new research into how babies operate, all the stuff we've been talking about? What can we learn that can help adults, help all of us, in terms of blue sky speculation and how to do that better?
Well, I think there's something to be said for every once in a while thinking like a baby. We tend to narrow our focus as adults so that we're just caught up in the everyday track of our plans and our intentions and our goals. And sometimes I think we need to step back and put ourselves back in that position of just imagining all the possibilities that the world has to offer. Travel is a good way of doing that. Go, when you go to a strange place, I think you have some of the same experience of the world that a baby does when everything's rich and different and novel around you. And certain kinds of meditation actually seem to do the same kind of thing. Open you up to everything that's going on around you in the world by letting you at least temporarily stop the narrow planning that we do as adults.
Mm-hmm. How will this change, or how should it change in terms of public policy and in terms of what parents do, how they go about interacting with babies?
Well, I think in a way the message for parents is very banal, which is just pay attention to your baby and play with your baby and give your baby lots of chances to explore the world and to interact with you. Those are the things that are going to be most important to babies. Parents don't need to have a curriculum for their young baby, and in fact that might be counterproductive. For the society, I think it's very important that we have support for this early learning that's taking place, but that support doesn't take the form of making preschools into schools, which is what some of the government programs actually explicitly suggest. It takes the form of giving caregivers support, so helping to provide support both for mothers and fathers and other parents, but also for the people who work in early childhood education.
Right. One of the things you talk about also is that the part of the brain that deals with sort of planning and focused kind of intelligence doesn't really take its final shape, doesn't really reach full maturity until our early 20s.
That's right. I, as I point out, for people like me who are parents of 20-somethings, this may be a rather depressing finding. But in fact, it turns out that our brains are much more flexible throughout our lives than we might once have thought. This part of the brain, which is the part of the brain that governs what people sometimes call our executive function, is still taking shape even when we're in our early 20s. And that's interesting in two ways. It does suggest this difference between an early human, babies or children, who are designed to explore, and then this older human that's much better designed to actually make things happen. But it also suggests that the programming of that part of our brain is actually based on the experiences and learning that we have as children. And in fact, there's even a study that suggests that higher IQ is correlated with later development of this frontal portion of the brain rather than earlier development. Mm. So keeping your mind open, literally as well as figuratively, seems to help make you smarter.
Where does all this fit in the ongoing debate and on the scale of the debate that rages all the time of human development between nature and nurture?
Well, I think the moral is that it's our nature to nurture. The thing that makes us most distinctive as a species is exactly our ability to learn about the world and to create new worlds. That's our evolutionary trick. So it doesn't really make sense to talk about a difference between nature and nurture, especially when it comes to human beings, because the deepest parts of our nature, the very way that our minds and brains work at a very fundamental level, are designed to allow us to learn about the world and imagine different ways the world could be. In particular, the thing that we can do much better than any other animal is to imagine possibilities. Imagine not just the way the world is now, but all the ways the world could be, and to make those possibilities real. If you look around the room around you that has a square desk and a light bulb and a computer, in some ways, that's a completely imaginary world. That's a world that didn't exist back when we were hunter-gatherers. So everything in our lives now is the result of this evolutionarily distinctive human capacity, a very deep part of our human nature that lets us change what our world is like and what we're like.
And it also is what makes this species different than all others, the fact that it takes so much longer, as you point out, for the brain to develop in humans versus any other species.
That's right. So again, if you're thinking about nature versus nurture, it's our nature to have this long protected period of learning. And in fact, there's some speculation that the evolutionary difference between us and our closest relatives, it could be just this little difference in our developmental timetable. You know, we share almost all of our genes with chimpanzees, and it may be that just that little difference in how long that open period of experience was available to us played a big role in giving us all the capacities that we have as adults.
What is the cutting edge of the research that's going on now? What more do we need to know in this arena?
Well, I think the big challenge now is to actually find out the details of how all this works. So what we've done for 30 years is to discover that children know much, much more than we ever would have thought, including very young babies. And we've also discovered, oh, here's what six-month-olds know, here's what nine-month-olds know, here's what three-year-olds know. What we're starting to do now is actually figure out the mechanisms that are responsible for that learning. So if you think about the brain as being a kind of computer designed by evolution, but a computer much, much more powerful than any of the ones we have now, what we're starting to do now is actually figure out what the programming of that computer is. We're actually starting to figure out exactly how that computer works, and hopefully soon figure out how the brain, how that computer is built out of neurons and brain tissue. Mm-hmm. And that's a very, very exciting frontier that we're just working on now. So we're actually collaborating with computer scientists who are trying to design these machines that can learn.
And will this lead us into perhaps better understanding of learning disabilities and things like ADHD and other learning problems along the way, and give us a better sense of how to approach those?
Well, I think we've already started to learn, for example, about syndromes like autism and Asperger's syndrome by understanding something about how it is that that we typically learn, and then trying to figure out what's going on in atypical populations who are learning. And I think one of the important morals of all of this work is that there isn't one thing that's learning. We're discovering that there are lots of different things that human brains do that allow them to learn in very different ways.
Mm-hmm. And are there significant differences? I mean, if you take a large population of babies, are there significant differences that you can see in terms of the way they approach the world?
Well, I don't think that we see very many differences in the basic capacity to learn. But interestingly, we do see big differences in babies' temperaments, in what their moods are like, and whether they're shy or outgoing or fearful or bold. And we see differences in the kinds of things that babies are interested in. So I think probably a lot of the things that we think of as being differences in intelligence or knowledge are really differences in what counts, in what matters to different babies. Some babies are fascinated by the small details of objects, and some babies are fascinated by how their own bodies work, and some babies are fascinated by other people. And we have good evidence that the more you're interested in something, the more you observe it, the more you learn about it, and the more motivated you are to learn even more about it.
It does bring us back to the importance of temperament again, I suppose.
Well, one of the interesting places where we do see differences very early on in development is in babies' basic approaches to the world. And there do seem to be these differences very, very early on between, you know, the fussy babies and the peaceful babies and the bold babies and the shy babies. But I have a whole chapter in my book about new research that shows even there how much our adult personality is the result of a complicated interaction between that early temperament and what happens in the world around us. So we've discovered that babies shape their parents as much as their parents shape the babies. The mother of a baby who's an active, squirmy baby is going to behave in very different ways than the mother of a little calm Buddha baby. And then that, in turn, affects the way that the babies behave, and then that affects the way that the mothers behave, and so forth. So even in the case of temperament, what we've discovered is that there's a lot there to begin with, and I think that's true across the board, much more than we ever thought before, but that first system, that first personality, is constantly interacting back and forth with the other people around the baby to shape the person who will be a grown-up.
Alison Gopnik. The book is The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. Alison, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.